The Sky News Centre at 6. Boris Johnson has insisted the UK will leave the EU on the 31st of October. That's despite government papers presented to Scotland's highest court suggesting he'll ask Brussels for a delay if a deal hasn't been agreed by the 19th of this month. Julian Morme QC is one of those behind the legal action in Edinburgh.
The Prime Minister's playing a very odd game because I think he told the House of Commons yesterday that we would leave come what may on the 31st of October. And I do not understand how that statement can be reconciled with the promises that he's made to the court today.
It's understood a 14-year-old boy has been shot in the leg during clashes between police and pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong. It's not clear if he was hit by officers or demonstrators. He's in a serious condition. The Metropolitan Police has apologised after facing criticism of its disastrous investigation into fake claims of a VIP paedophile ring in Westminster. A report's been published into the 16-month inquiry, which ended without a single arrest. A metal-producing company where two workers died in an explosion has been fined £1.8 million. Kesler Steel pleaded guilty after the blast in Cardiff in 2015. Police say they've taken the most criminally active firearm in the UK off the streets. The pistol was used in 19 shootings. Today, 15 people have been jailed for their roles in crime gangs in Merseyside that handled it. Detective Chief Inspector Steve Reardon says they had to catch those using the weapon.
These individuals aren't the old organised crime groups with loyalty and some sort of pride in what they do. The chaotic individuals who are very quickly, too quickly, will use firearms to settle petty disputes.
And a member of cabin crew made jobless by Thomas Cook's collapse has walked 200 miles to hand in a letter to the Prime Minister. Rachel Murrell hiked from Devon to London to demand an investigation. That's the latest. I'm Kit Bradshaw.
The Bristol Cable is hiring. Do you want to break into journalism and hold the powerful to account?
BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is the leader of the Lib Dems. No, it isn't, actually. It's not going to be the leader of the Lib Dems. It's, well, possibly the Lib Dem mayor, Mary Page. Also, Richard Ford is Brexit Party candidate for Gloucester. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, well, Trump says threats to impeach him are energising him. He comes out fighting, asking the Chinese to dig up dirt on his potential Democrat opponent, Joe Biden, as well as Ukraine. Who is this CIA whistleblower? How was the transcript to this telephone conversation with the Ukrainian president published? Plus, the film out this month about a local lass's role at GCHQ trying to prevent the illegal Iraq war. It's called Official Secrets. And hidden links only now coming to light about child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein and the links he had with the US tech giants. Was it blackmailing them that got him killed? Oh, sorry, he committed suicide, didn't he? In his New York jail cell. If not, what did? Also, super brains for the opening of Black History Month on something called the Black Legend, the idea that we can return to a golden age by reversing all the colonial changes brought about by... Oh, sorry, the cultural changes brought about by colonialism. Now, that's not to say colonialism is good. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 16 Celsius. Cloudy tomorrow, sunny intervals, windy on Sunday. Next week, highs at 16 still, feeling cooler, light rain, showers, some sunny spells and windy. Next weekend is the 12th and 13th of October, highs of 14 Celsius, showers, some sunny spells and windy. That was Bristol's two weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Mary Page. She's the candidate for mayor for the Lib Dems. Hi Mary, welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Tell us a little bit about how your campaign is going and your chances of victory, I suppose. You're completely convinced that you'll win.
Actually, it's looking really good. Our polling data...
Everyone says.
It does. Our polling data is showing a sort of 2-1 in favour of scrapping the role of mayor and putting democracy back in the hands of Bristolians, because that's what we want to do. And in fact, the odds are shortening. When the Lib Dems were sort of in the race for the mayoral at the beginning, we were about 1,000-1. And apparently, I'm told reliably by the Green Party, that our odds, now that I'm the candidate, have shortened to 5-1.
Okay, well, the Lib Dems used to run Bristol, but we've got a bit of a problem, haven't we? How are you going to shake off all this thing to do with the coalition government, bringing in austerity with the Tories and all that? You know, tuition fees is a very tainted brand, isn't it, Lib Dems?
It is, in some ways, if you're prepared to... look at the reality of the past, not the fantasy, though. That's the thing that really matters. And the Labour Party produced a budget and were proposing a budget that was for £82 billion worth of cuts and austerity measures, which is £1 billion more than the coalition actually delivered and £2 billion more than the Lib Dems proposed in their budget if people had actually voted Lib Dem to get Lib Dem.
Okay, so £82 million more.
£82 billion is what...
£82 billion more, Martin.
No, not more. It's £1
billion. Okay, £1 billion more. Anyway, Martin, Summers, I think we'd like a chance to answer that accusation, Martin.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you went into coalition with the Tories and what you put in your manifesto didn't really mean add up to much. And, of course, what's now happening with Boris Johnson deciding to cut taxes for the wealthy in particular and increase spending on everything is that apparently the deficit doesn't matter anymore. And, of course, it didn't really anyway.
To support tuition fees. So both Labour and Conservatives wanted tuition fees.
Well, that's why there's been a revolution in the Labour Party.
The Lib Dems were the only ones who didn't, and yet people didn't vote for that.
Okay.
So if you want Lib Dem policy, the only solution is to vote for Lib Dem policy.
Okay, we're also joined from Gloucester by Richard Ford, who's Gloucester's prospective parliamentary candidate. Hi, Richard.
Good evening.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where have you come to politics from? Have you been a councillor? Have you been involved in politics before?
No, I've been involved in politics for about 4 or 5 years now. Before that, I was in business, in travel industry tour operating, so my whole life was in business.
Tell us about Thomas Cook. What happened there? We had a look last week at it all, and there were £250 million of credit default swaps, not by one person, as I erroneously said, but by several people betting that Thomas Cook was going to go down. So a lot of people made a lot of money out of Thomas Cook's demise.
The Thomas Cook thing, I think, at the end of the day, the amazing thing is it lasted as long as it did. It goes back 10 years or more. It's been a hugely indebted company, an accident waiting to happen, not just because of the changes in distribution in the travel industry through the internet and so on, but a massively indebted company also owned ultimately by German interests. It was at one time Westdeutsche Landesbank that owned it. I don't think it still is, but I noticed the German wing didn't go into administration. So lots of reasons, but certainly not, as Lib Dems and others have said, oh, it's all because of Brexit. Nothing to do with Brexit. The problems at Thomas Cook would predate Brexit by a considerable amount of time.
And they said it was something to do with the uncertainty, too, around Brexit that didn't help. But anyway, actually, it does look to me as if there was enormous bonuses given to directors, senior people at Thomas Cook. Sorry to stick on this subject, but there's so many people who were affected by it. Any chance of clawing those back? And I mean, it does look as if those people may have thought, well, let's take as much money out of this company as possible because we know it's going to fail.
Well, we don't know that's the case, but obviously there is an issue sometimes in company insolvencies when the company may be going insolvent, but the company still has assets. The directors can declare a dividend and obviously draw money out of the company, provided that they get a resolution of the general meeting. And so that may well have happened there. I don't know that it did happen, but it's a possibility that it could have happened. But of course, it's a very bad look when that does happen, and thousands and tens of thousands of people are put out of work. And of course, there was a big trade fair up in Manchester, I think, yesterday at the airport. Lots of those people will get other jobs, as they did after Monarch, which happened 2 years ago. So these things happen, but, you know, a company the size of Thomas Cook that's been in business as long as Thomas Cook has been in business, there's never one single reason for its demise. It isn't just the exchange rates or just because of Brexit or not at all.
You seem to be implying that, that it was the Germans that made this decision to pull the rug out from underneath them. Well, are you doing you're sort of seeing everything through a Brexit prism?
Not at all, no. Ultimately, it was owned by Germans. I think it still is. I don't know that for sure, but I think it was ultimately owned by Germans. And I noticed, I didn't follow the report that much, but I noticed that the German wing and Condor Airline, which was owned by them, it's a very long-established German charter airline.
Plus the Indian branch of Thomas Cook as well survived.
Well, but there may be profitable bits that were taken off, and which sometimes happens in company insolvencies, is the debts are shoved into the bit that's going to be put to the wall, and then that liberates the remaining part, makes it more profitable to sell. But I don't know that. I'm surmising.
Thomas Cook, where these sort of huge bonuses are taken out by a company director, and it's happened with Jamie Oliver's restaurant chain, where he's taken out £5 million, and then, you know, all of their workers have lost their money. And I think that absolutely the Liberal Democrats would be standing up for those workers' rights much better because of the way we want to revolutionise our banking system and, and decarbonise our financial systems.
Mary, I've got to ask you, what's your pitch for the city? If people vote for you, what do you think will change? I mean, would it be just sort of going back to the Barbara Jenk days, whatever it was, 10 years ago or something?
You should never look back. And I think that's my point of the fact that, you know, we constantly hear other political parties sort of saying, oh, but we're not that party now. Well, you know, that's the same. None of us can change the past. We can only make our futures better. And that's what we must focus on for Bristolian. You learn from it. Absolutely, yeah, sure. Indeed, Richard. And I think that the thing that we can grow on for Bristol is we can get more people involved. I've just been looking at the figures of the Quality of Life survey, and there is a dramatic drop in the trust that Bristolians have in the city council and their trust in the mayoral system. It's down below a quarter of the population are in favour of that system. And so, you know, that trust of politicians and that trust...
There's no trust in any politicians of any
absolutely.
Party.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I can say is I'm not a politician. I think like Richard, you know, Richard said he's been in business. Myself, I've been in the last 6.5 years in manufacturing and composites technology industry and, you know, a lot of my rest
okay,
of my...
Just a little bit more specific. A composite manufacturing, what are we talking... What was churning out your factory door then?
It wasn't a factory itself, it was a research institute. So we supported Airbus, GKN, Rolls-Royce and other major manufacturers in the UK, keeping high-value jobs
with EU funding, of course.
Absolutely, with EU funding.
Paid for by the British taxpayer, sent to the EU.
Hang on, Richard. The problem is,
lots
with
of
things
EU funding.
Like GKN, I mean, I spoke to people at GKN, what was it, even five years ago, saying, oh, well, we think this is... The whole of Filton site is going to be cleared, that most of the engineering stuff work is going to be going. It certainly seems that, I mean, I think GKN's been sold off. You know, this kind of thing's happening, isn't it? Not guaranteeing jobs if a foreign country or company owns GKN.
Well, not guaranteeing jobs if we leave Europe, and that is the real risk. All of those major manufacturers sort of wrote in support of remaining because they understand the importance of that EU scientific funding, the Horizon 2020 programme. All of that. Bristol is an engineering city.
Well, there are thousands
of
young graduates who will be looking for jobs up at Filton. Yeah. I want to hear both from you, Richard, and from you, Mary. What difference will Brexit make, if any, to people getting, with you first, Mary, to keeping jobs in engineering and getting work up at Filton?
I think it's that thing where, you know, if you take stock and you stop before chopping your leg off, you can always decide that that's a good thing to do in the future again. But actually, that's how the people who wish to remain in Europe and negotiate a better deal in Europe, quite happy that... You know, the position of the Lib Dems would be to say that actually we hear the message of half the country that says we are unhappy with our relationship in Europe and we want a better relationship and we will go in there fighting, but it is so much better to change the system from the inside. And the parallel there for me is the parallel with what I want to do with Standing for Mayor. I want to get inside the system so that I can then give Bristolians a real choice about how they run their city and get them more involved.
Surely actually the only real difference can be made is in central government.
There's lots of difference that we can make here in Bristol and in terms of applying for pilot schemes to do things and in terms of being self-determining of our own success.
Okay, Richard Ford from the Brexit Party, what's your thoughts about whether or not Brexit would or wouldn't affect people getting jobs at Filton? But people rely on these when they graduate, when they come out of school, they want jobs.
Well, the fact of the matter is business needs certainty, and what it's had the last 3.25 years has been uncertainty. And where there's uncertainty, the investment decisions which create the jobs, which create the wealth in the country, won't be happening because they'll be put on hold, because business, as I say, wants certainty. And I have to say, you know, the Liberal Democrats have created uncertainty by fighting the democratic will of the British people to leave the European Union the last 3.5 years. We had Theresa May and the Conservatives dilly-dallying about for 3.5 years. We had Jeremy Corbyn sitting on the fence. We've now had the Lib Dems come out and say they're going to revoke Article 50. What David Cameron said was, if you vote on a Thursday to leave, we'll be invoking Article 50 on the Monday. He didn't do that. He resigned. And it's been downhill since then. So the investment decisions haven't been made. People have cut back very often because of that uncertainty. And when any company does cut back, for example, Honda in Swindon, it's always blamed upon Brexit. It isn't always the case. There are often other reasons why things happen. For example, in the motor industry, electrification of vehicles and so on is, you know, uncertainty. For the high street, it's very often the internet. As the travel industry, it's the internet. So let's not blame Brexit all the time. The fact is, the whole country, the whole of the South West, although not Bristol, I admit, certainly Gloucester voted to leave by a considerable margin for a democratic country. That needs to be happening. And it's not happening. And with the latest news, it looks like there's going to be another extension. So that takes away faith in democracy. It gets people staying at home, not bothering to vote. And it allows companies who are not doing well to scapegoat Brexit, to find reasons why it's not the fault of those directors or that company or the market's changed, they haven't kept up with it. It becomes, oh, that's Brexit.
I think we can agree on that level of uncertainty being very and deeply unhelpful.
Your party has created
I don't think we have.
We're
giving something completely certain.
Have.
We are giving a known deal. All the details. No customs border between us and Northern Ireland.
Well,
no customs
have,
border between
moved, Mary,
Northern Ireland and
yeah.
Southern
understand,
Ireland.
Understand that. But you
we
think
have
moved this
certainty.
Week. Let's have a listen, I think. It'd be quite useful to discuss what's been put on the table this week by Boris Johnson, his 5-point plan announced when we could listen to forever to his conference speech. But let's have a listen to what he put to the House of Commons, the 5 points, where he's trying to get round this whole problem of the backstop, which actually Boris Johnson and David Davis last July left, resigned because of the backstop, and he's now come back with a plan, hopefully, to fix it. Not that necessarily it's going to fly.
The essence of our new proposal is a new protocol on Ireland and Northern Ireland consisting of 5 elements. In the first place, all our actions are based on our shared determination to sustain the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, the fundamental basis of governance in Northern Ireland, the protection of which is the highest priority of all. And from this follows the second principle, namely that we shall, of course, uphold all the long-standing areas of cooperation between the UK and our friends in Ireland, including the rights of all those living in Northern Ireland and North-South cooperation, the common travel area, which predates both the Good Friday Agreement and the European Union itself. Third, we propose the potential creation of a regulatory zone on the island of Ireland covering all goods, including agri-food. For as long as it exists, this zone would eliminate all regulatory checks for trade in goods between Ireland and Northern Ireland. But fourth, unlike the so-called backstop, such a regulatory zone would be sustained with the consent of the people of Northern Ireland, as expressed through the Assembly and Executive. They will give their consent during the transition period as a condition for these arrangements entering into force. Thereafter, the Assembly will vote again every 4 years, and if consent were withheld, these arrangements would then lapse after 1 year. Fifth, it has always been a point of principle for this government that at the end of the transition period, the UK should leave the UK as the EU customs union whole and entire, restoring sovereign control over our trade policy and opening the way for free trade deals with our friends around the world. And that is a fundamental point for us, Mr. Speaker. So under the proposals in this new protocol, Northern Ireland will be fully part of the UK customs territory, not the EU customs union. But there will be no need for checks or any infrastructure at or near the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Indeed, I have already given a guarantee that the UK government will never conduct checks at the border, and we believe that the EU should do the same. So there is absolute clarity on that point. Instead, under this new protocol, all customs checks between Northern Ireland and Ireland would take place either electronically or, in the small number of cases where physical checks would be necessary, they would happen at traders' premises or at other points in the supply chain.
Boris Johnson speaking in the unprorogued House of Commons early this week, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the thing is, this isn't going to run. It's been made pretty clear by the Irish government that they're not going to buy it. And it's pretty clear that there isn't a majority in the House of Commons for it either. So he's the Prime Minister in name only, because he hasn't got a majority.
What is there a majority in the House of Commons for?
We don't know. There is a question.
A majority for stopping Brexit happening, isn't there?
There's a majority for stopping a no-deal Brexit, that seems clear. Although Michael Gove this week was suggesting that there might be a majority for this deal because the DUP have signed up for it. But it's not a deal because the EU haven't signed up for it and the Irish haven't signed up for it. And of course the fundamental problem here is, because of the war in Ireland and all the rest of it, Northern Ireland voted to stay in the EU, 65%. And and Scotland also voted to stay in the EU. And ultimately, the logic of having a no-deal Brexit is we're going to have to break up the United Kingdom, like Yugoslavia was broken up in the 1990s when I was an aid worker over there.
But
it's not necessarily a bad thing,
sovereignty is a very dangerous affair. That is not being acknowledged here, that if UK is going to leave the EU, then there is going to have to be a border of some sort.
Yes, and that's got to be in the Irish Sea, and you could easily have a no-deal Brexit if the DUP weren't propping up the Tory government. Now, in actual fact, the DUP are no longer propping up the Tory government, because the 21 Tory rebels means that they haven't got a majority anyway, so there's a question about whether he should have a Queen's speech.
There's a lot of talk about the Good Friday Agreement, and I had a look at the Good Friday Agreement earlier this week, and I put a link up to the BBC article which pulls it apart and quotes it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And what the Good Friday Agreement actually says is that the border will return to something commensurate with the hostilities ending. So that means that they'll be taking down the army watchtowers, but it doesn't mean no border. That's the Good Friday Agreement's actual word.
Well, the border's still there on the ground, but if you go there, you will see that it's a it's just not there. It's in one side of a field and not the other side of a field.
So what I'm saying is, all this talk about, oh, you're breaking the Good Friday Agreement, all they're saying in the Good Friday Agreement is no more army on the border.
The head of the PSNI this week, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, has said quite clearly their officers will not, because once you put any customs borders in place, the real IRA and the continuity IRA will start shooting customs officers. They've made it pretty clear. Then the police come in to protect the customs officers, they shoot the police officers, then you have to bring in the army to protect the police officers. And people who think that this war is just over because it's over are deluded. It's
okay,
not
anyway,
necessary. The loyalist paramilitaries won't necessarily accept a United Ireland.
Let's have a listen
either.
To Richard Ford. He's the Brexit Party candidate for Gloucester and the prospective parliamentary candidate. What do you make of Boris's proposal and the whole backstop business?
Well, the whole backstop business has been manufactured. It was never discussed at the time of the referendum. It's been brought in subsequently. It was a concession given by May and the Tories that was totally unnecessary. I would point out that Sinn Féin have got 7 members of Parliament who are abstentionists and don't take their seats. They could take their seats and have some play in this, but they don't do that. I would also point out that the DUP, it seems to me, are in line for another bung. I saw them at the Conservative... They've got it, have they? I saw them at the Conservative Party conference. Clearly, they've been bought off. As Nigel Farage said, this is a pig with lipstick on it, I think is what he said, and that's basically it. It's reheated. Varadkar's probably not going to accept it. But the UK, of course, is... the Republic of Ireland's biggest trading partner by far. And Boris Johnson then, one of the few true things he said in the House of Commons was he referred to the common travel area. Now, the common travel area dates from partition of Ireland in 1922. And it worked. It meant that was the reason why Irish men and women could come and work in the UK. The currency was linked. All these things did work when they were separate countries. Ireland had its sovereignty and the United Kingdom of Great Britain of Northern Ireland. The Republic of Ireland had its sovereignty and the UK and Northern Ireland had its sovereignty. So these things can be made to work. But of course, it suits the European Union, it suits the establishment within the European Union to create this particular problem, to trip up Brexit happening. And, you know, there are plenty of examples of, you know, the Republic of Ireland isn't the only external border of the European Union. There are other examples in Norway, in Switzerland, in Liechtenstein,
Norway is in the customs union, etc., isn't it?
Sure. But there are every example is different. The Faroe Islands, of course, is part of Denmark, but they're not within the European Union. You know, the Channel Islands are not within the European Union.
Okay, so is Boris's deal going to fly?
No.
Okay, Mary, what do you make of his attempt here to get rid of this backstop, which seems to have been such a hassle?
Balderdash and buses and Boris is about all I can say to it. I mean, this man is a proven liar in the courts. And I don't think you can trust him as far that, as any one of us can throw him. He is suggesting a regulatory authority. Now, most people haven't worked with Vitchlin Goods or Bonded Warehouse. I have. I worked back in the days in Dover Ship Stores, and we were dealing with all the paperwork that ensues with bringing goods into a country when they don't actually come into the country. I mean, the same issue applies to all of the conservative promises about free ports, which actually we can have. There are currently free ports already in existence in Europe. So a regulatory authority sounds to me like this is a ruse to have maybe a free tax economy over in Northern Ireland, just in order to make money for his very privileged friends. And I just can't trust it. All of the numbers don't add up to him getting this deal through. And all of the points that Martin has put forward in terms of the majority of the Northern Irish public wanted to remain.
I mean, Martin's basically saying that we could just see a return very, very quickly to people shooting, killing each other. Martin, you are. That's what you're saying. If there's a hard border. Can I just get your reaction, Richard and Mary, to that? Well, what did you say? Go on.
Well, I think the danger is there. We've already got the possibility of Republican dissidents who are not representative of the majority at all, but they've made their position pretty clear. And what may come out of this is if there is a no deal Brexit, which drags the North out of the all island
and
economy,
a border and customs checks and police and army.
The problem could be the loyalist paramilitaries won't accept a vote for a united Ireland in the six counties, which of course Sinn Féin are calling for. And they may win it because the democracy is going their way. Now, the problem, I'd like to think that people on all sides, I've got more sense than to do anything stupid like that. So don't misquote me by saying that.
You did say it was a possibility. Anyway, before we go any further with this, let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn, Leader of the Opposition, his response to Boris's proposal this week.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to thank the Prime Minister for an advanced copy of the statement. But what we have before us is a rehashed version of previously rejected proposals that put the Good Friday Agreement at risk, that would trigger a race to the bottom on rights and protections for workers, consumers, and our precious environment. Given the seriousness of this issue and the vagueness of the proposal so far, can the Prime Minister tell this House if and when he plans to publish the full legal text that he must submit to the EU? These proposals would lead to an even worse deal than that agreed by the former Prime Minister. The Prime Minister signed up to the backstop in Cabinet, and he voted for the withdrawal agreement as a backbencher. His letter to the President of the Commission yesterday claims both are now unacceptable. Perhaps he can tell us what has changed. Why did he support it then but oppose it now?
Martin?
Well, you'd have to ask Boris. I mean, Boris Johnson was being asked the question by Corbyn there. I think the fact is that if the DUP hadn't ended up propping up the Tory government, it would have been quite possible for the Tory right wing to get a no-deal Brexit agreed with the EU, but they've got to exclude the Northern Ireland from it. But they can't do that because the DUP are the only thing holding them in place because they didn't win the 2017 general election.
So, Richard Ford, where is this taking us now, do you think?
Well, I'd just like to say, pick up on what Martin was saying, the balkanisation of the UK. Now, it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, a union of England and Scotland, including Northern Ireland, so long as and Wales, of course, so long as the people living in Northern Ireland or in Scotland wish to remain. They had a referendum in Scotland, and yes, it may be in 30, 50 years' time that the people who want to reunite Ireland will be in the majority, but currently they're not. So there's no balkanisation. Mm-hmm. And Mary was saying for the Lib Dems, oh, yes, well, you know, Northern Ireland voted differently. They voted Remain. It was the country which voted. I could say, well, Yorkshire voted in a certain way, or Bristol voted in a certain way. It's the United Kingdom that voted.
In 1922, the border was drawn by the British. The nine counties of Ulster have actually already have a nationalist majority. They've always had a nationalist majority.
Well, it was the Anglo-Irish Treaty, wasn't it?
No, the Anglo-Irish Treaty, but originally the border was supposed to be drawn like the border in Silesia on the basis of a population.
But isn't this the whole point of the backstop, is to bog everyone down?
Correct.
It's trying to sort out Northern Ireland.
Correct. In actual fact, the EU would love to have this situation resolved, but the Irish problem will not be resolved. But many people in Middle England think that the Irish problem is just made up. It's been the main point in Irish British politics for the last 50, 100 years.
Just let Richard respond to that. Yeah?
It's been totally made up. And to conflate the Good Friday Agreement with leaving the European Union, it's disgraceful what the Labour Party... I mean, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats and the Greens and other parties have done. And the Tories have let them get away with it. The fact of the matter is, it wasn't discussed back in the day of the referendum.
It wasn't.
If it was that important, why wasn't it discussed then? You know, it's a manufactured problem through May being probably the world's worst Prime Minister and being very weak. Theresa May, she allowed that to be put onto the table. It's totally manufactured. And yes, of course, no single person wants to see police officers.
Mary, how would you sort the backstop out? Could you, do you think? Or do you want to?
I think it is a really, really challenging problem to sort out, and that's why 40 years of peace in Europe with the European deal has been very, very good for peace across Europe for keeping the peace. Both of them have been very good at keeping peace. And you know what? I'm the only woman in the room again. And the reason I got into politics is because all I see is white male millionaires, Corbyn included, talking. And you know who's going to be burying the bodies if the fighting breaks out in Ireland
again? It's totally alarmist. It is going to be the women.
It is going to be the wives, the daughters that are going to be burying those people and mourning people predominantly.
This is Project Fear writ large. That's all the Liberal Democrats do is, you know, create these fearful problems.
It's absolutely nothing to do. I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying that there is an issue here
Can I just pin us down for a second to a poll that's come out this week, which is looking at the difference between what people think about UK voters preferring a no deal, actually thinking it might be a good thing, or comparing that to having Jeremy Corbyn in number 10. Now, this was commissioned by the Daily Express. The research suggests UK voters would much rather have a no-deal Brexit compared to Jeremy Corbyn being in Downing Street. Now, of course, it does make a difference who commissions these polls, because they generally tend to... But the figures are pretty extraordinary. 48% saying they prefer a no deal, 35% saying they want Corbyn in number 10. So whose
poll was this?
This is a Daily Express poll. I'll put a link up to it.
But people just want to get on with it. That's, you know, I'm from Gloucester, as you said. Go into Gloucester, as you do most Saturdays. Most people, and Labour voters, Conservative voters, many other voters, people who don't even vote, say, we just want to get on with
it. You're a businessman. How on earth can you possibly say that Brexit will be over? I mean, that is a preposterous thing to say in terms of that. Yeah. We will be negotiating trade deals for the next 10 years. There will be no upturn in the short term. There are a significant number of people in this in this country who will not see a real benefit before they're hitting.
We are definitely getting bogged down in Brexit here. One of the things I'd like to do would be is to just ask Martin what he thinks, because Jeremy Corbyn could have had a general election and he hasn't. I cannot get Thangam Debonair to come on this programme and discuss Brexit. I haven't been able to for the last year or so.
Well, Labour have chickened out.
But she was on one of the Daily Politics programmes talking about this. And so here is the Bristol MP Thangam Debonair for Labour explaining when she thinks a general election will actually happen.
Well, you've got the largest majority in the West Country at the moment, but that doesn't necessarily mean any seat is particularly stable. When would you vote for a general election?
Well, this week I think we've seen yet again how politics can move at a rapid pace, and the thing that you thought was important in the morning has kind of disappeared from your mind by the evening. I've already forgotten which Tory MPs yesterday said they were resigning or got kicked out, because so much has happened since then. And in that environment, it's very difficult to say that we would vote for a general election as we did not yesterday, because we're in such uncertain times. I think it's important that we put the national interest first. My constituents want me to put the country before party, and they've told me very, very firmly that they want the Brexit mess sorting out before they want an election. Now, a lot of my constituents do also want to change a government, as do I. But we're not there yet. We haven't got out of the chaos.
Well, the reason Thangam Debonair and Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party don't want an election is because they're going to get totally hammered. That's the only reason, and whichever way they concoct it, that's the fact. And
Martin, I guess you don't agree with that, do you?
No, of course not, but let him finish.
And you know, in Gloucester, I wrote to the parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party and asked her what Labour's policy on Brexit was, and frankly, she didn't answer, and the reason she didn't answer is because she doesn't know. And I've been critical of Mary tonight, but at least with the Liberal Democrats, you do know what their policy is, and that's why they're doing better. You know, it comes back to the uncertainty thing. That's why Labour's doing badly. And people have got no confidence in the Labour Party. We've got people come up to us in Gloucester, Labour voters, they voted Labour, their grandad voted Labour, Labour all their life, and they're not going to vote Labour again. Some are going to vote Brexit, some are going to vote Lib Dem, but the fact of the matter is they ain't going to vote Labour because they've totally lost confidence in the Labour Party and in Jeremy Corbyn, and that's why they don't want an election.
Martin? I think that's probably Martin. Something we can...
Can I just say, the reason why we haven't got a general election is because the other opposition parties persuaded the Labour leadership to block a no-deal Brexit first. Corbyn's instinct was to call an election, but the SNP, Plaid Cymru, the Greens, one Green MP, and the Liberal Democrats said, don't do this, because what will happen if we have a general election campaign at the minute, Boris Johnson and Cummings will force a no-deal Brexit on us
so
in the middle of an election campaign.
Can't Jeremy Corbyn make his own mind up?
No, he's got to work with a coalition, which I've always been in favour of PR myself. Well, we should have a coalition. Can I just finish? What will happen, I think, is that we won't go out on the 31st. I think we can all agree about that. That's not going to happen,
I agree,
is it? And then there will be, in an order fashion, I hope, a general election in which those who want a no-deal Brexit can vote for Richard or others who want a no-deal Brexit, and we will see how the votes stack up. But
and
of course,
really
I say
want to
everybody's
remain,
got to. I'm not actually that bothered about Brexit one way or the other. I would perfectly happily accept a soft Brexit. The Norway situation seems perfectly okay to me. They're in the single market. They've been asked twice to vote about joining the EU. Both times they said no. So they don't have to spend money sending people like Farage and Ian Paisley to
Europe.
Okay,
so let's get on to some other things. Richard Ford from the Brexit Party, can I have your final word on the B word?
Well, it's not going to happen on the 31st of October. Boris Johnson's a total opportunist. He's more interested in being Prime Minister than anything else. And, you know, he'd sell his own grandmother. So the fact is, on the Brexit word, there is only one party in Gloucester that's standing for Brexit. We've got a Remain Conservative MP. We've got the Labour Party is in favour of Remain the candidate, the Lib Dems, the Greens and all the rest. So, frankly, people of Bristol, people of the South West, if you want Brexit delivered, vote for the Brexit Party.
OK, and the Mayor candidate next May for the Lib Dems here in Bristol. Mary, what's your final word on Brexit?
I think our manifesto is pretty clear. It's bollards to Brexit, you know, amended there for the listeners' ears. But... you know, there are 37,215 people in Bristol West alone who signed the Revoke Article 50. It was the petition. It was the largest Remain voting constituency in that way in the country. And I think people in Bristol have got a very clear choice now. If you want to remain, vote Liberal Democrat to get Liberal Democrat, to get that. There is a clear policy. If you're not bothered, if you want a no-deal Brexit, choose one of the other parties. We are very clear what we stand for, and we are prepared to stand up for that and your rights to remain.
And once Brexit is finished, we will be able to talk about some of these other issues, which are really important. In fact, a terrific story by it was ITV West Country this week. Homeless deaths, I say terrific story, it's heartbreaking. Homeless deaths have tripled in the West Country in the past 5 years. So whilst we've been twiddling our thumbs talking about Brexit, deaths in the West Country have tripled in the last 5 years. Homeless people.
Absolutely shocking. 82 people left.
That's more than a fifth in the past year. They've increased, according to the Office for National Statistics. The total deaths has tripled. Southwest has the highest rate of deaths amongst rough sleepers outside London. The Bristol alone, 17 people died in 2018, a significant rise in the year before. Mary, what do you take this? I mean, someone knows the city pretty well. What do you put this down to?
I've had the fortune recently to be working quite closely and talking to a number of Bristol's homelessness charities within a project called Living Without a Home. We will be having a project meeting about that on the 2nd of November. If anybody wishes to get involved, look for Living Without a Home or contact me, Mary Page, on Facebook, Mary Page for Bristol Mayor. But you know, it is a very serious problem here and challenge.
Why?
For us.
Why is Bristol's, you know, the worst problem outside London is what they're implying here?
A combination of reasons in terms of there are actually so many charities here to help. You know, we have Roots who will be giving out support packs outside the Marriott on a Thursday night. We've got Help Bristol's Homeless. We've got some Mungos. We have supported independence, and so many more here. And so actually people are so kind and so generous that there are so many volunteers.
You were talking about the difference between men and women earlier. I mean, this is completely the opposite end of the scale. 88% of these deaths have been men in 2018.
They are.
Why is that?
The particular issue that we're looking at with Living Without a Home is the tie-up between mental health care and social health.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Divorce as well.
Absolutely. And in the Bristol area, unfortunately, there has been a disconnect between the social care and the mental health.
One of the things that people turn to... that's important. But one of the things that people do turn to when they are homeless, because you're basically in despair, you're looking for anything to comfort you, to get you through the day, is drugs, isn't it? And that's
and
been
drink.
Cut back.
Not necessarily statistics. I can't say the word statistically, but you know, there is a number of people who can, and you can look for help with the Bristol Drugs Project there. But I think
if they were here, they'd say, "Well, hang on, we've been cut back over." Really, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's Lib Dem austerity. You know, less money coming from central government, less money going on these sorts
of
rehabilitation services.
We've had 5 years of Conservative austerity, please. I'm sorry.
Well, the Lib Dem MP in Cheltenham supported the bedroom tax. He voted for the bedroom tax. Martin Horwood, the Lib Dem MP. The Lib Dems supported the Conservatives with the bedroom tax 5 years ago. So you were involved in that austerity agenda, and you can't escape that.
Richard,
Mary, just a final word on the homelessness. You know, if you do become mayor, what would you do?
There is a really... comprehensive homelessness strategy just been published, 2019 to 2024, 5-year study. I have to speak to the experts here. This is one where, as a politician, you have to say, I don't know all the facts, and I work with the charities. And I think there is a way of pulling all of those projects together and making sure the four steps are covered, so that you have a housing first policy. So you make sure there's, you know, people are able to access the housing, no questions are asked for those who want it. But critically, one of the things that we do need to do is help those people who are too afraid to get into the system. And, you know, the mental health system is failing them.
Martin Summers, I mean, one of the things that if the city's working well, if politics is working well, you know what? It acts like a bit like a family. So people who are vulnerable do get looked after. Why is that not happening here in Bristol?
Well, look, with the banking crash in 2008 led to a situation where the private sector, financial sector was bailed out at the expense of the
rest of
society.
It's not a crash.
Well, there's going to be a proper crash coming down the line soon. It won't just be Brexit that's going to cause cause all of these companies to crash. You're quite right about that, Richard. The problem is that
economic cycle.
There is, yes, and of course this is because basically what's happened, and economists across the spectrum, both left-wing and right-wing, are pretty clear about this. You're not supposed to bail out banks like that and then just let them carry on. It was originally supposed to be a short-term measure.
It was a Labour government that did it.
It's a Labour government that did it, but don't forget we've had a big fight in the Labour Party to get rid of the kind of complacency that was in...
But nevertheless, a Labour government.
Oh, yes, of course. But at the same time, because of the electoral system, we're a big coalition. So you've got a right wing who are
Richard, what's the Brexit Party's strategy to stop people dying who are homeless?
Well, we have the same problem in Gloucester. It's a smaller city. There are less people, but pro rata, it's still a problem. A lot of veterans, which is very worrying. It's a funding problem, isn't it? And we can only fund things if we have the tax revenue with which to do that, and it's properly allocated. Now,
aren't I right in thinking people have been banned from begging in Gloucester? So if you're asking for 50p, have you got any money, then you can get arrested in Gloucester.
Well,
I think the Vagrancy Act here in Bristol.
I think some
and
of those
Leila
people
Moran
actually were not homeless.
To ban the use of the Vagrancy Act.
Sorry, that they were not homeless, some of those people, I think. That was the issue. And they were going to beg, although they weren't actually in need. But, you know, Mary, you say, OK, and I completely agree, it's awful and it's awful to hear, but, you know, your party would happily sign up to spend £39 billion to leave the European Union, yet that money could be used in part to help fund Bristol's homeless, couldn't it?
We've already spent far more than that in the last 3 years, and you know,
you spent more than £39 billion.
I don't think so. In terms of
No Deal Brexit, preparations,
absolutely, all of that,
anyway,
and
look,
the future.
Okay, you're
we'll
trying
have,
to go
we'll
back to Brexit
that.
Again, Vox, yeah, aren't you? You're gravitating towards that giant. Sun
Let's talk about the homeless because actually,
but
it's not
it's linked.
Just
it's linked because our eyes have been taken off the ball.
Just let Mary finish.
It's not just the rough sleepers. In Bristol, we have around 82 rough sleepers per night, but that is just the tip of the iceberg. That is only 3% of the homeless population. 97% go unseen because they're in temporary housing.
And that's an indictment upon our society, isn't
it?
It
is.
Okay, right at the other end of the scale, what we've got is we've got royals who've got so much money they can take people to court for publishing letters. That is the letter of, I'm talking about the letter of Meghan Markle to her father. Before we discuss that, let's have a listen to Prince Harry. He's over in... I always think of him as a local lad, having bumped into him outside the cash point at Tetbury Tesco's. I was wondering at the time, I said, what does Harry need so much cash for? Surely he can just pay for things by card. So I think I'll leave that to listeners to speculate as to why Harry might need great wads of cash. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Prince Harry on his final day of his tour of Africa.
I've often talked about Africa as my second home, and I've often been asked why I love it so much. Well, over the last 9 days, I've been trying to put my feelings and experiences into words, which is not easy. I wanted to try and answer a more specific question for myself. What is the essence of Africa? Why is it that so many visitors feel Africa gets under our skin and into our soul? Last night, I returned from my third visit to the fourth poorest country in the world, Malawi. Despite extreme hardship and ongoing challenges on so many levels, people are generous. They are strong, humble, and incredibly optimistic. I know that there are daily struggles that most of us couldn't begin to imagine. Yet I have seen strength, resilience, and a sense of hope and empathy that I can only aspire to replicate. Ever since I came to this country as a young boy, trying to cope with something I could never possibly describe, Africa has held me in an embrace that I will never forget, and I feel incredibly fortunate for that. And every time I come here, I know that I'm not alone. I always feel, wherever I am on this continent, that the community around me provides a life that is enriching and is rooted in the simplest things. Connections with others, and the natural environment. And as I raise my own son, I want to make sure that what I've learned here, the value of the natural world, the value of community and friendship, is something that I can pass on to him.
Well, that's Prince Harry speaking over, I think it's in Malawi, the final bit of his tour of Africa. A great contrast with the homeless people we were hearing about earlier, Martin.
Well, I think he's obviously not going to be a homeless person, but I don't think anything that he said in that speech is contemptible or disreputable. You might think it's a bit hollow, But on the other hand, I think he's not doing anything terrible there, is he?
What he's been doing with this letter business this week is comparing his mother to his wife.
Well, it's the Mail on Sunday that got
most
hold
men
of the letter.
Do, don't they?
The Mail on Sunday got hold of the letter, didn't they? They've got to justify their journalism, and I'd rather talk about Brexit than talk about this letter, to be honest with you. That's serious politics.
Well, let's hear from Richard then. Richard, what do you make of this trip, Harry's words, and also this business about suing the Mail on Sunday over the letter?
Well, I listened to Radio Gloucestershire last night, and there was a former editor of the local paper on there, and he was saying that Harry had been very badly advised to pursue this, and it seemed to make sense what was being said. At the end of the day, you're talking about extremely privileged people, incredibly privileged people, who are there in this position not by want of their own effort. They're there by birth or marriage, and I think there is a price to pay for that, and the price to pay is an element of public scrutiny. And I think if you call the press in when you want to do something to get a benefit, you can't then complain when it's something that you don't want to be seen. You can't be the world's great environmental campaigner and fly around in private jets. And, so I think probably Harry's got a bit of growing up to do there, and he should take advice from other people, it seems to me. The Queen's been amazing, but she's 93, 95 years old, whatever she is. The royal family are there. They're not elected by any of us, but people say, what would you replace them with? Would it be President Blair or President Cameron or whatever? So, we do have a royal family, but I think it behoves those people in that very privileged position to conduct themselves in a manner accordingly, and I think also they should have an element of public scrutiny. I think that comes with the territory, to be honest.
Mary, what do you make of this?
I'm probably slightly less Lib Dem about the royal family and the fact that absolutely not going to revoke the royal family, in the fact that the city where I come from, a huge amount of tourism business and revenue into this country is brought in by having a monarchy and bringing that over. And you said about what would we have, president? Well, God forbid that we had President Trump here, and that
President Blair would be pretty awful, wouldn't it?
I reserve judgment on that
President
individual,
President,
but
Swinson.
Absolutely. Much as I might think that that's a good idea, actually, we have a royal family, we have a tradition, and we have some tourism, and we have an awful lot of local
but
businesses.
But is it right to publish the letter?
That's a challenge, isn't it? In terms of, and that's one for the law courts.
They need to be held up to scrutiny.
One of the things that her father has said is that he didn't want to publish the letter, but he was forced to publish the letter because the royal spin doctors had been putting out complete falsehoods about what was said in the letter. And so the only reason, and he, by the way, didn't get paid at all for sending it to the Mail on Sunday, the only reason he sent it over to the Mail on Sunday, he said, look, do what you want with this, because what the royal family is saying about what's in this letter is clearly nonsense. That's the sort of thing I imagine which will be being argued about, potentially in the courts anyway.
I think that's the issue about spin doctors, though, isn't it, really?
I think it's an issue about freedom
of the
press, to be
honest. We've got a spin doctor here in Bristol City Council being paid about £91,000 or £98,000.
Kevin
Slocum
being paid.
Does Kevin
Slocum tell the mayor what to do?
Well, who knows? I'm not privy to those circles.
I think the press needs to be freedom of press in a democracy, and there needs to be scrutiny, and things need to be held up to the light, and sunlight clears everything. The problem we're in at the moment, in so
open
many
democracy.
Areas, so many, well, you're revoking Article 50, which was a democratic, anyway. The fact is, it needs to be held up to public scrutiny, and once we stop doing that, that's a very, very slippery slope, and if you're in a privileged position, whether you're a politician or a member of the royal family or whatever you are, you have to accept that scrutiny.
Papers, I would make sure that it was all published because it's public information.
We've got such
let's have the Western Harbourside documents
local,
published.
Local media with the Bristol Post, fantastic local paper.
All these Q&As with Marvin.
Yes, with Marvin, yeah. So do you want to talk about that briefly? Because that was this week, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I went to the first Q&A and managed to actually get a question in by default of the fact that they didn't know it was from me. Then I was going with a friend and their name was
published. Stage managed?
Couldn't possibly say that. You might, people might think that. I've seen the comments on Twitter about the most recent one where, this is meant to be members of the public being able to ask questions, and yet the deputy mayor was one of the people in the audience asking the question, you know, taking up valuable time.
And who
time.
Was chairing it? Well, the boss of the, or the editor of the Post, I think Mike Norton, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it'd be great. I've asked them whether or not they will organise a Q&A to include all of the mayoral
candidates. And
you know
what? None of it was recorded, so you can't actually listen back to it afterwards.
We have a democratic deficit in this country, and that's one thing I can agree with the Lib Dems on, and also with you, Martin. We drastically need electoral reform. There needs to be accountability of politicians, and that's the reason, actually, why I believe we're in the situation we're in, is because we have a Remainer Parliament elected by a Leave-voting public.
Hang on, we're back to Brexit again. No, stop. One of the things I would like to talk about, though, very briefly before we finish, is the Scotland becoming the first UK nation to ban smacking children after MSPs voted to outlaw parents using any physical punishment at all on their children, because this is a pretty contentious thing. I mean, many countries have accepted it, and a lot of other countries have not accepted it. There's already some pretty strict rules about how hard kids can be smacked, and it's quite legal to do so long as you don't actually leave any kind of bruise, I believe, or any kind of mark. Is that right? I think at the moment in Britain, but they're saying no smacking at all. And if you do, it's going to be a criminal offence in Scotland. Could be heading down this way. Martin Summers, what do you make of this? These laws coming in smacking kids?
I work with young people, and we're trained what physically we can and can't do.
But you're not their parents, are you?
No, but at the same time, I think the Scots would say, well, this is in line with what Scandinavia does. They banned smacking in Scandinavia decades ago. And in actual fact, I used to live in Poland, and they banned punishment in schools. We banned them in this country in 1986. We were the last country in Europe to ban physical punishment in schools, but it was banned in Poland in 1793 as part of the rebellion against Russian oppression.
So, Mary Page for the Lib Dems, what do you make of this? So which side of the debate are you on?
I think we have to agree that being a parent is a really, really challenging thing to do. There is no handbook on how to be a parent. However, I think all of us will agree that violence is not a solution. There should be more talking, and there should be more support for people and across the board in every situation in life, in order to be how to listen, how to communicate. And it is very challenging when you have a screaming toddler in front of you. That doesn't justify smacking in any way, shape or form, and you know, we must stop any violence against children.
I mean, when kids play up, they do, don't they?
But are you allowed to use physical violence on them? The problem is that even moderate physical violence is very hard to police by society. Yeah? And I think the other, I mean, what happens in Scandinavia is they've banned it, but of course they don't necessarily drag people to court. They give them
let's hear Richard's view anyway.
Well, bits of all that's been said, really. I mean, I agree with Mary. Being a parent is a very, very difficult thing to do, and we don't want to criminalise parents who may have lapsed or whatever. So, you know, of course, parents that totally bully and intimidate, the extreme cases, need to be policed and with social services. But, you know, there needs to be an element of discipline. And I think, you know, speaking as a man, having been an adolescent boy in one time, you know, there needs to be control. And sometimes those young lads can be very difficult to control. And if there needs to be other outlets for young people.
But we all agree that the positive agenda is that we shouldn't get into the situation where kids are being hit at all.
Yeah. I agree.
It's a bad thing in principle. Even
that.
Where it happens.
I agree.
And in the past, I mean, my father was a head teacher in Liverpool in the 1960s and 70s, and I went to school when it was normal. And in actual fact, I work in schools now, and the schools do function without it.
What about, for example, a young child is persistently bullying, say, another sibling?
Well, yeah. Something has to be done about it.
Or they have a propensity for running out into the road.
What used to happen, actually, when physical punishment in schools was the norm, is the tough lads used to soak it up and then dish it out even more.
But we're talking about families rather than schools.
At the same time, in families, what I think, if you set in general, we're against this, but it's a bit like having the seatbelt in the back of the car that anyway, everybody's supposed to put on.
One thing I will promise to do is I'll put up a link to the original letter. I don't know if I'm going to get sued for that, but a link anyway to the Mail article with the Meghan Markle letter to her father, so you can make up your own mind as to whether that was the right thing to do or not. Thanks to our guests.
Thank you very much.
Richard Ford, who's the Brexit Party candidate for Gloucester, and also to Mary Page, who's the
Lib Dem candidate for Bristol.
Thank you
very much. Buckingham Palace has confirmed claims have been filed at the High Court on behalf of the Duke of Sussex. The move concerns the illegal interception of voicemail messages. Our royal correspondent Rhiannon Mills says the family have been targeted before.
Back in around 2014, during the height of the phone hacking scandal regarding the News of the World, it transpired that Prince William and Prince Harry's voicemails had been intercepted, and as a result, stories would appear in the newspapers.
Documents suggest Boris Johnson will ask for the Brexit deadline to be extended if a deal isn't agreed by the 19th of October. The papers were discussed in a Scottish court, but the Prime Minister's responded, insisting the UK will leave by the end of the month.